which is Travelers Property Casualty Company of America versus Talcon Group. Mr. Dickey.
May I proceed?
Please do.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Mike Dickey from Dunlap and Shipman in Panama City, and I represent the appellant in this final oral argument, Talcon Group, LLC. As the court is probably aware from the briefs, Talcon is one of a group of companies that's owned by the same family, the Nisi family. They're developers, they're contractors, they're real estate brokers. In one instance, there's a limited partnership that acts as the bank in their developments. Here, we're dealing with Talcon Group, which acted as a general contractor, primarily in underground utility work. Now, in the summer of 2019, as the court's aware, they branched out into something different, and Talcon decided to build two spec homes in Santa Rosa Beach, Florida. It, at that time, had the installation rider on its inland marine policy that we're here to talk about. That was the policy that was in place. And a bad thing happened. The Musset Bayou fire on May 6, 2019 burned those two houses and pretty much the rest of the neighborhood as well. Coverage was denied by Travelers when that claim was submitted by the appellant's agent, Wyndolph Insurance, and in a subsequent declaratory action, summary judgment was granted by the district court, which leaves us today with two primary questions that this court needs to answer. The first is whether the district court could determine as a matter of law that this loss was not covered by Talcon's installation rider on its inland marine policy. And the second has been articulated different ways, but basically it comes down to whether there's an issue of material fact as to whether Talcon either suffered a financial loss, as that term is laid out in the policy itself, or had an insurable interest under Florida statutory and common law. This court should answer both of those questions in the negative and reverse the summary judgment. What's not at issue in this case? Should Talcon have bought a builder's risk policy instead? It seems to have been extensively argued. This court doesn't have a builder's risk policy in front of it to compare as to what does what. But we do know that there are some differences that are articulated in the record between
But
the
we
two.
Do know a builder's risk policy would have covered it. It wouldn't have been a problem here. Well, I think we all know that.
And Travelers seems to lay that out and enforce in this.
Well, I mean, it's that's what it's all about. This was under construction. It's a builder's risk. It would have covered this. This is a different type policy that's a property coverage, I guess, as opposed to a liability policy.
Yes,
this is not a liability policy like a builder's risk. This is a property loss, property damage policy. Would that be a fair, just to get oriented to what we're dealing with?
That's generally correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Builder's risk is a little more breadth to it, but in this context,
a lot more breadth to it.
Here is what amounts to first party property insurance
right.
for the insured. And an installation policy, unlike a builder's risk policy, it applies to everything that this insurer does as a contractor, and it's not underwritten basically job by job as a builder's risk policy would be. And we'll get to the significance of that in a moment.
Doesn't the contract define everything that this entity does as, I think it was 98 or 99% underground utility work, and then 1 to 2% things related to that work?
Well, there are two different documents that the court may be referring to, Your Honor. The first is the policy itself, and this is where we get into this discussion of where it defines the property that's insured as primarily underground utility work, and I think it says the states of Florida, Alabama, and Georgia. And then we get to a separate document, which is the heavy construction template. Now, the heavy construction template was prepared by the agent The first year this policy was in effect, because if you recall, you had a policy in effect in August of 18 that was renewed in August of 19. The heavy construction template was filled out in 2018, and it has the percentages that, the court's referring to with regard to 98% underground utility and then 1% to 2% site work. That same form is what was attached by the agent when the renewal came around, and what's significant about that is there was no updating of it at that point. It was just the old 2018 form that said on the front of it, it's the 2018 form. So that's what the insurance company had in front of it. By that time, the permits had been pulled for this job in May of 2019. The renewal was in August. So it was completely true when it was filled out. It wasn't by the time the renewal came around, but the old form was attached. So returning to the language of the policy itself, where it talks about under installation what's covered property, it says that the contractor will be primarily involved in underground utility work in those three states, and then it refers to that as a job site. What's happened at the, I want to interrupt if you've got a question, but what happened at the district court level was sort of a change in the way that that was interpreted. What the district court took away from that was that the job itself had to be primarily underground utility construction, and then whatever else happened there would be ancillary to that. Well, that's not what the policy says. Policy says, in terms of the work that my client was engaged in, correctly, primarily underground utility work, and that's the primary insured risk. It's not the exclusive insured risk, but it's primary. So what happened here, under the terms of an installation policy, generally what happens is you've got an insurance period that essentially terminates when the work is accepted. So in this case, I think there's testimony from, I believe it's Mr. Wallace or Mr. Webb from Travelers, that at the time this, you get a certificate of occupancy, basically the insured interest ends to the extent there was one. So if you're a contractor, you're an electrician, you're a plumber, you're a roofer, your stuff is out there. It's not been accepted yet by the owner, and that stuff is destroyed, and there's an agreement by Travelers that fire is a covered peril. There's at least some record testimony from the Travelers folks that vertical construction would be covered. In those instances where you've got work that has not made it to CO yet, that work would be covered under an installation policy, but for this primarily underground utility language that we see within the policy itself.
So ordinarily, I'm trying to understand what this, what probably Travelers expected this to cover. What types of, set aside this new spec house enterprise, what types of risks was the company trying to insure against with this policy?
Your Honor, as you pointed out earlier, it's basically a property insurance policy. So what you're covering, if you look at the policy itself, is you're covering goods and materials that have been delivered to the job site. You're covering the company's equipment that's on the job site that's being used in the course of the project.
If you have all the utility materials stacked up to use the next day and then there's a fire, then it would cover that. Is that the sort of thing?
Correct.
Okay.
Precisely correct, which raises the question again, and I couldn't get in the depositions of the Travelers representatives, nobody could articulate for me, because it seems fairly central to all of this. What would be different about the risk that's presented in building a spec house and having a pile of pipes or boards or shingles sitting out there for this, and what goes into an underground utility project from the
My guess is the extreme magnitude of the materials, right? I mean, it costs a lot more to build a house than it does to put the utility features underneath the house.
Well, I don't want to stray outside the record, Your Honor, but I think in the kind of projects that my client primarily did that were governmental-type projects, they were big enough that, I would put to you that if you're doing, for instance, I think there was one deposition was taken in a job trailer at where a drain field was being put in for Escambia County. You're talking about big, big projects. So, which is why one of the functions in underwriting and figuring out what they're insuring isn't to look at the individual projects. For underwriting purposes and actuarial purposes, what they look at is the volume of work in terms of your annual receipts, and they look at your loss runs, basically. So,
Talcon decided to build an office tower, then that would also be covered, right, under your view of the agreement?
It would, as long as they're still at that point in time primarily engaged in the work of being an underground utility contractor. They could certainly do that, and there would be coverage for their materials at the job site. up until that project was accepted and completed in the form of a CO. That's correct.
But materials totally unrelated to underground utilities.
That's correct. Right. As long as the primarily, if you look at the way it's drafted, goes to what the contractor primarily does. And again, it's because installation policies are ensuring an enterprise, if you will, a contractor, rather than a series of individual projects, which is more typical of what you would encounter in the builder's risk setting.
In your view, is it primarily in terms of the dollars of their work or the kind of number of projects? So if they have 100 minor underground utility installations and then one gigantic skyscraper in downtown Atlanta, is that one project versus 100 other ones? So they're primarily involved in underground utilities still, or does it?
I would put to you, Your Honor, it's probably not, and here's why. The way that we're told in the record that in the deposition testimony that installation policies are underwritten is based on the number volume of the contractor's work. So if you're saying primarily and 98% of your revenue is coming from an office tower, and then you've got some, 100 little dog and cat utility projects, that's going to show up in the aggregate number, and you aren't going to be able to say you're primarily engaged in underground utility contracting if that's the case.
Okay, so, with your time left, you haven't covered financial loss and insurable interest at all yet. So that, to me, is the heart of the case, because I could say the policy is ambiguous when it says the property installed consists of. And if you go read description, underground utility contractor, I mean, that doesn't make sense that the property installed consists of a contractor. That's not it. I think you go to a job site, or it's not covered, and job site's defined. So let's assume on coverage, there's some argument, it's ambiguous, and there's coverage, but you have to have a loss, a financial interest, or an insurable interest. And I have a problem with that, because you don't have title to the homes, you don't have, you never put any money in the project. That is your plaintiff here. So I couldn't figure out, other than possibly you might have made some profit, they may have made some money and given it back to Talcon. Tell me what your loss, Talcon's loss, is. Because it didn't look like to me that there might be coverage, but there's no insurable or financial loss here.
Well, the loss to Talcon that's been briefed, and you've touched on one of those, is that Talcon was going to get paid at the back end of this project when...
There's no written contract about that.
That's this milieu of family business that they...
Well, I don't care what the reason was. There's no written contract. There was allegedly some oral understanding, right?
There was. And
there was no terms to what the oil was that they were going to get paid. It all depended on how the project went, whether they made money or not.
Well, Your Honor, probably the primary thing, and this is an important point that comes out in the cases, is that the insurable interest, the financial interest of the contractor, may not be coextensive with the whole project. And in this case...
But Talcon wasn't the contractor here.
Your Honor, respectfully, the record shows that Talcon was the contractor.
Okay.
Dionysius was the qualifying agent for Talcon.
So you're saying he was getting the permit for Talcon as the contractor, so that he's the contractor here because he got the permit.
He swore to that in his deposition, Your Honor, and he also said that Talcon's account numbers were being used for at least a portion of the goods and materials that were delivered to the...
But he also testified Talcon did not put a dime in it. They may have used the account numbers, but they were all paid by his own company or by him personally or other bank accounts.
His wife advanced some money, the limited partnership.
I know, but the point is no bank account of Talcon put any money in the project.
That's correct.
Okay. So how do they have a financial interest or a loss here? You say they were going to get something at the back end.
Right. They had money advanced by others. It'd be no different than if you've got a contractor that's got limited financial resources.
And it's an oral understanding, and there's no terms as to whether it's going to be percentage of profit. There's no terms with regard to what they're going to get at the end. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Other than that, what else shows an insurable interest or a financial loss?
Again, Your Honor, I think that the primary direct vehicle for that would be the fact that these Talcon accounts were used at least in part with these various vendors. Now,
but they didn't lose any money because all the vendor accounts, they were paid in full, and Talcon never paid anything on them. Is that correct?
Well, that's correct based on what's in the record, yes.
Right. I mean, so I let my son use my credit card, but he pays it all off. I didn't pay a dime. I don't have a loss. That's kind of what happened here.
But now Talcon is back on this project rebuilding two houses.
Well, that's not what you're suing for.
Well, again, all that the court has to determine at this point is whether there's a fact issue as to whether Talcon had
I'm going to accept the facts in the light most favorable to you to see whether you proceed. And so I'm trying to find out what your financial loss is under the facts in the light most favorable to you. And one is you say there was this oil agreement at the back end to get some money and that they use your vendor accounts. And is there something else?
Zachary Nisi in his deposition also pointed to the fact that as a contractor, his perception, at least, is that he's financially responsible. Now, you know, he ended up not getting any money out of
financially responsible to who?
To the vendors who made deliveries at the job site.
But they all got paid, and they all got paid by somebody other than Talcon. They've all been paid.
Correct.
There's no outstanding lien or anything on the project, right?
Which is precisely why a developer owner would go pay those to make sure that there isn't a lien out there.
Right. And they paid it out of non-Falcon accounts.
They did.
Right. So I'm trying to understand, other than they used the vendor accounts, even though there was no money, they used the account numbers, say, I guess, at suppliers, wherever. Is that what it was?
That's exactly right. Suppliers, okay. Material.
But they've all been paid, and they never paid anything from Talcon. And then the back end. Is there another item we should look at besides those two items?
Well, again, the back-end expectancy, I mean, Talcon didn't do this for free, and so it ended
I understand. The back-end expectancy, the vendor accounts. I'm just trying to see if there's a third thing, or that's it we need to evaluate.
I think you've covered
the two things. All right.
That's correct, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Ackerman.
May it please the court, Winston Ackerman for Travelers Property Casualty Company of America. Talcon bought property insurance to cover its underground utility contracting installations. This was water and sewer lines, and it was doing it entirely for municipal or government clients, is what they told Travelers. The policy would cover, going to Judge Grant's question, the policy would cover things like if they had an incident where they released a bunch of water. They released a bunch of sewage on property for which they would be legally liable. The policy would cover those kinds of things, in addition to also their own equipment, their own building materials, as was mentioned. Just to clarify a question Judge Hall had pointed out, a builder's risk policy actually is property coverage. It's not liability coverage. It's just a different type of property coverage that would cover precisely this type of thing. So if you're building a house, you're building a new commercial structure, you can buy a builder's risk policy that will cover that during the course of construction for fires and lots of other things.
So if they had been building these spec houses and there was a problem caused by the underground utilities that resulted in destruction of the house, you're saying that that would have been covered?
Well, they didn't do any underground utilities at this.
No. But just in this complete hypothetical, if there had been some sort of underground utility at the house that they had been working on, and then they added the spec house on top, and a problem with that underground utility had damaged the spec house, at that point, you're saying Travelers would have been responsible for the damages. But since this was something caused not by the underground utilities, then it wouldn't be covered. I just want to make sure I understand your argument.
Correct, yes. Okay. I mean, it would still have to be property for which they are legally liable. So the policy covers, if you go to the this type of coverage analysis, we always start with a grant of coverage. So that's, document 40-1 at page 89. Policy covers direct physical loss or damage to property, certain types of property, what they define as covered property, from any of the covered causes of loss, which is any risk of direct physical loss that's not excluded. the particular covered property that's at issue here is defined as installation. So then you need to go to the definition section of the policy as to what installation is defined as. Installation is defined as property described in the declarations under installation that's either owned by you, and none of this was owned by Talkin, or property of others for which you are legally liable. So Talkin would have to be legally liable. There'd have to be a finding that Talkin is legally liable to somebody else, typically the property owner for which Talkin is working, that you or your subcontractors will install, erect, or fabricate at the job site. And so property described in the declarations under installation, and this is what is really unique to this particular policy, they write this into each individual policy. What is the installation they're covering? And here it's underground utility contractor operations in Florida, Georgia, and Alabama. At this project, at this particular site where they're building these, where the spec homes were built, by Zachnesius, there was no underground utility contractor operations being performed at all. One thing that I think is important here, and was not mentioned during my my friend's argument, is the application for insurance is part of the policy under Florida law. That's Florida Statute 627.4291. And the application here included the heavy construction template. That was in an affidavit of the underwriter, which is document 46-2 at paragraph 7 and 9. So that heavy construction template has to be considered under Florida law part of the policy. This court also explained that in your decision in United Specialty. And that
can you give me the cite to the heavy construction template again?
Sure. The heavy construction template is, the template itself is at 40-3, and the relevant page number is 86. The other site I was giving is the underwriter's affidavit, which specified that that template was part of the application, and that's 46-2, paragraphs 7 and 9. So that's part of the policy. That has to be construed as part of the policy, and I think that resolves any potential issue as to whether the whether this policy covers this risk, because the heavy construction template said they did 0% residential work. It said it was all underground utility work, 98-99%, and site development, 1-2. So the site work would be, preliminary work to do your underground utility work. And we don't dispute that it's primarily underground utility work. So if they're doing something that's part of an underground utility project and they're doing something related to that that might not be exactly on the utilities themselves, that would be what the primarily language is designed to get at. I mean, even in my friend's reply brief, they described it as ancillary. Like if there was ancillary work, the word primarily contemplates other ancillary work. That's not what was at issue here. This was entirely different. This was Zachnesius on his own doing this project using family money, none of which came from Talkin.
And this says municipal/government is 100% of the current breakdown of work, right?
Right, and this project had nothing to do with that. This project was building houses to sell them to private owners with the goal of making a profit.
What does job site 2 mean on the, I don't know if it's the deck sheet or the front page where you have the description underground utility? It says job site 2. What does that mean? It's to the left of description.
Yeah, so job site 2, if you go to the, you have to start with kind of the definition section. So definitions is at, document 40-1, page 109. Job site is defined as the premises where the installation will be permanently located, basically when you finish the work. So job site 2, there's no job site 1. I think that's just because they did have a building that was covered, their own building, their own office was building 1, location 1. So they called the job site 2, but job site 2 is described as their underground utility contractor operation. So they, rather than listing every individual place where they might do work, the underwriter broadened it to anywhere in these states where they're doing underground utility contractor operations.
Job site is defined as where the installation will be permanently located.
Correct.
Okay, at completion. And when you start on the first page, this is my confusion, it says installation. The property install consists primarily of, and it doesn't say what the property installed is. It says, if you go to description, it says the property installed is underground utility contractor. That's not property that's installed.
Yeah.
It doesn't really fit. That's where I got hung up and why I went to loss and insurable interest, because it doesn't. Install consists primarily of, and then you've got job site two, okay, but we don't know what job site two is. There's no definition of that. So if I look to the right and I read the sentence to try to make it a sentence, consists primarily of, and then it's got description, underground utility contractor. That's not a property. That's a contractor. So is that how you're reading it? If you go down to the...
Yeah, so I think that...
But it doesn't read together is my problem.
Yeah, there's two or three words that perhaps should have been inserted there, but it's the description there, I think, is the definition of job site two. They probably should have said locations where underground utility contractor is performing operations. It's intended to be a location when you read it as a whole. If you go right above to page... the bottom of the preceding page, it says location, description, and co-insurance. That doesn't have anything to do with co-insurance, but the location is the location where. It should say location where. So there's a couple.
Anyway,
of
so you read this above. Front page is saying the property installed is location where they're doing utility work and nothing else.
Primarily utility work.
Yeah, I'm going to the coverage issue. Okay, well, he says... All right, so you say primarily, okay, because primarily is in there. So he's saying, well, I have coverage. I'm not saying it's right. I'm just trying to understand how I read these terms together. The property install consists primarily of, and you're going to read it, an underground utility contract, which you say, well, you need to read in where the underground utility contract is performing utility work. Why wouldn't it be where the underground utility contractor is performing work? Just
performing
any work.
Any work.
Well,
because they have to be an underground utility contractor. I don't think it's an unreasonable interpretation of the policy to say as long as they're an underground utility contractor, if they want to start, you know, going to Judge Grant's question, building a skyscraper, that we have to cover that. It has to be the operations that the policy is intended to ensure, and you have to read this together with the application.
But you have to read out primarily then.
No, because if they were doing primarily underground utility work, but they had to, I don't know, put in some electricity in order to be able to run a pump, then we would cover the electrical work that's part of that. It's ancillary to the primary work at the site. It has to be a site, a location where they're doing primarily underground utility work, and then if there's something related to that.
Did you say that the heavy construction template is part of the contract, in your view, under Florida law, part of the insurance policy?
Yes, okay. Under this court's decision in United Specialty and also the statute I cited, I think it's 627.419, that's considered part of the policy.
And how do we read it as part of the policy? I think, to me, that certainly shows, I would say, what was intended, but how do we loop this in to be mandating that sort of limitation? Is it because it defines the scope of coverage, or is it something else?
It defines what they were doing, which is water and sewer lines for municipalities, most importantly here, 0% residential. So I think to interpret this policy as covering building new residential homes would be completely inconsistent with the application, which is part of the policy, and therefore an unreasonable interpretation of the policy. Moving on to the other two issues, I mean, there's really three different alternative reasons to affirm here. We talked a lot about one of them. The insurable interest issue, the statute there requires an actual, lawful, and substantial economic interest. There was nothing actual or substantial here in terms of Talcon's economic interest. What I think is important there is this court's decision in Banta Properties says If you're going to be a family operation and you're going to set up different entities, we have to treat them under the law as separate entities. You can't just sort of merge them all, combine them all as one simply because it's all owned by the same family. So I mean, it's clear here there's no contract entered into by Talcon with anyone.
Well, he says the qualifying agent was that family member, and he was only a qualifying agent for Talcon, and the only building permit here is by him as the qualifying agent, not for his own company. So what is your response to that?
Yeah, I mean, they can tie it only with a licensing number. So when you look at the actual permitting documents, and I can find the site for that, but those permitting documents, 40-7, they have Zach Nezias's individual name. They have, I believe it was one of his home addresses, and there's no reference whatsoever to this Talcon Group LLC.
I agree with that. On the permit, there's nothing on except his individual name, but they say it says his name, comma, qualifying agent, because permits can only be issued in individual names, right?
Yes.
The county or whoever the entity is doesn't give permits except in individual names. And so they say that shows that the contract was with Talcon because he was the qualifying agent under his license number only for Talcon. So I'm just putting forth what they say so you can respond to it.
Right. Yeah, there's, I think, two things there. There's a Florida statute, which is 489.131, subsection 12, that says that licensing statutes do not create a civil cause of action. And there's another statute, which is 553.84, saying that a violation of a building code creates a cause of action only in some very limited circumstances, not at issue here. So I think this licensing aspect doesn't create civil liability. It's true that he used that license. So if he did something wrong at this house and the authorities wanted to try to take away his license, he would be the one they would look to because he's the qualifying agent for Talcon. But that's a licensing issue. It has nothing to do with sort of the relationship between the
contractor. So you're saying that didn't make the contractor on this job Talcon?
Doesn't make them the contractor. They didn't enter into any contract.
But is there in a record for these houses a contract with anybody, or are they just developing them? That is, the individual, the son or whoever he was just developing them for his own.
Just the son.
So there's no contract. Construction contract with a third party out here.
There's no construction.
They were
contract.
Spec houses, and then he was just building them for his own business.
Yes, that's 42-1 in the record at page 43. There's no contract entered into by Talcon, no contract with its subcontractors, any of that. This was all sort of on their own.
Right, and so he says, what about the financial interest under the old agreement? They would get something at the end, and the account agreement, account numbers or the vendor accounts they used to build this project.
Yeah, there's no agreement. There was no even oral agreement that Talcon, this LLC, would get any of the money.
Okay, so you're saying there's no oral agreement.
No oral agreement that Talcon would get any of the money. There was some reference to a very vague oral agreement that the money would be split between, I guess, the father, the son, and the daughter-in-law in some respect. But there's nothing saying specifically Talcon would get this money.
Well, where would the money come from if they were going to split the money?
They were intending to sell the houses, so they were just building these to sell them. The son was also a real estate agent.
So eventually the money that was going to be split would have come from the sale of those homes, which some could argue that means that Talcon did have a financial interest, even if it was based on an oral agreement.
Well, the sale of the homes, presumably, it appears, would be by a trust. So the land on which they're building these homes is another entity. It's a family trust. So if you were to sell these properties, the contract would be between whoever wants to buy them and the family trust. The money would go to the family trust and then get split up among the family members.
Right, on the back end, which would still, I guess, influence or implicate the original agreement in terms of splitting money. It just clarified where that money would come from and at what time or period of time that money would be split.
Well, Your Honor, there's no agreement that any of it would go to this particular insured, to Talcan Group LLC. There was no agreement to that. The father testified he wasn't even sure if he would put any of it into a Talcan account. There's no reason it needed to go into that. This was sort of a family. The family was looking to make money for their own personal use, essentially.
Thank you. We appreciate your argument. Mr. Dickey, you've got 3 minutes.
With the time I've got left, I'll focus on the issue of insurable interest, because that seems to, the court has already kind of identified the struggles of trying to reconcile the heavy equipment template and primarily and what's job site two. The policy is not exactly a model of clarity here, and that speaks for itself. With regard to insurable interest, you know, the first point is that in looking at the list of things that are in the reply brief and the initial brief, you know, one of the points that's made is that an insurable interest is something that a contractor has in the materials that are on site. That's based on Traveler's own testimony. And 627.405 says basically that you have an insurable interest in subsection 2, I believe it is, in something that you got a legitimate economic interest. If Talcon is the contractual counterparty with the vendors and that gets paid for, no matter who pays for it, those are Talcon's materials until they're accepted, and then obviously they burned up and catching fire is an insured loss. The Banta case came up, which this court decided previously. The thing about Banta to keep in mind is, first off, it was at the end of a non-jury trial. There were enough fact issues there in that rather informal mix of family entities that there had to be a trial. But what came out of the appeal wasn't that there is no insurable interest, but rather a really circumscribed one, because the Banta entity that was the insured was a property manager for the company. And the property manager, I think it said, got a 1.5% property management fee based on the value of what they were managing. And so what looked like a very big claim turned into a very small claim. But what's noteworthy there is it did not go away altogether. Likewise, when you're looking at insurable interest, the Meerdink case talks about a trustee holding bare title as another example. The Duffy's Tavern case says a tenant can't insure a building that burns down because they don't have an insurable interest. Those are examples of not having an insurable interest. Here you've got building materials sitting on the site, at least some of which were ordered by Talcon on Talcon account. And that, coupled with 627.405, gives Talcon an insurable interest here.
With regard to the old agreement, he seems to argue, well, the old agreement was that the family members, the father, the son, and the daughter-in-law said, we'll split something up at the end. That it was not an old agreement with Talcon, it was with the father. So what do you say about that? If I go to the record to see what they testified to, what do you think it's going to tell me?
What it's going to tell you, Your Honor, is Rick Nisi, who's the CFO or the qualifying financial agent of Talcon. He's in the limited partnership that did the funding. He's part of the trust that owns the dirt, that he's going to make a unilateral decision at the end of this, if they make money on this project, as to how they're going to divide the proceeds of that.
Oh, so he's going to make a unilateral decision.
Well, that's the way he describes it, is that he's the one who's going to decide if there's profit, how that's going to be divided up to pay the folks who participated in this and created that value.
I thought you said there was an agreement that it would be split. That seems different than him saying, than one person making a unilateral decision.
Well, there's an agreement that it was going to be split, Your Honor, but in terms of how that split was going to happen, apparently there was a fair measure of discretion in that. So that's the rub. You've got an agreement, yes, but not a lot of detail as to what that would entail.
I think you're over your time. Does anyone have any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. We are in recess until this afternoon at 1 p.m.